Thank you. I'm not sure if I had specified a very precise title, because what I want to discuss is some theoretical work that we have done on photon condensation, and I'm going to spend some of the time, more towards the end of this talk, discussing a particular toy problem about modeling coupled systems coupled to buffs, which comes out of this photon condensation problem, but where I'll talk in more detail about a particular toy example that will allow us to compare exact and approximate solutions. So what I want to do overall in this talk is to first spend some time introducing what photon condensation is. And I know that Martin Weitz was here earlier in this meeting, but I think there's been enough turnover of people that I should give a general introduction to the physical system before I start talking about the theory. And then I'm going to talk about the sort of simplest version of the theory that we've looked at, which will describe most of the experiments done in the first couple of papers on this, and then move on to talking about effects of spatial pattern formation, which is relevant to more recent experiments. And I should say that the work I'm going to discuss here has been done almost entirely by a postdoc of mine, Peter Curtin, in St. Andrews, and most of the work I'm going to talk about is either in a couple of papers that have already published or in preprint 1506.00280. And I will mention later on some other references for the toy problem where when that becomes appropriate. So the physical system that I'm talking about, at least my favorite cartoon of it, is a microcavity where there are curved mirrors, and inside the microcavity there is a dye, and this is an experiment, rhodamine 6G dye in solvent. So the way you should think about this is that there are some dye molecules floating around in here, but the dye molecules are fairly dilute. There's a lot of solvent molecules per dye molecule. And the basic physical picture of what the experiment consists of is that you shine an external laser on this, which excites the dye molecules. And then the dye molecules emit either into the cavity or potentially out of the cavity. And then the light in the cavity goes backwards and forwards and can be reabsorbed by the dye molecules. And so the physics of this system is what happens to the light as it gets absorbed and re-emitted by the dye molecules, and what does that lead to in terms of the properties of the light that comes out of the cavity. So the cavity is not perfect and light will leak out. And the point of the experiments is that what you see in the light that leaks out is firstly that if you plot the spectrum, plot it on a logarithmic scale, you can see a Boltzmann-like distribution. And as you pump the system harder, you can then see a Boltzmann distribution with a peak appearing at low frequencies. And at the same time that you see that peak appearing at low frequencies, you can also measure enhanced coherence times, and you can measure that in real space, so I'll draw a picture in real space, that you get a collapse from a sort of thermal Gaussian beam to a sharp beam, which corresponds to the lowest transverse mode in this cavity. And so this accumulation at low energies coming out of what was a Boltzmann distribution is described as being Bose-Einstein condensation of light, because you see this Bose-Einstein distribution appear and you see condensation in the sense that there is a macroscopic occupation of the lowest transverse mode. Now, what I'm going to try and describe is that this system, the physical system here, this is dye molecules in a cavity, and you pump them and you see coherent light coming out. This is not that dissimilar to the basic description of what is a dye laser, because you have dye molecules which absorb and re-emit the photons, and this, when pumped in the right way, leads to coherent emission of light. And so the starting point for why we looked at this system was to try to understand why is it that in this particular experiment you see something which looks like a Bose-Einstein distribution and you see something that you can understand in the context of condensation, whereas that's not what you normally see in a dye laser? And what is it particularly about this physical system that tells whether you should see something that does or doesn't look like condensation? So I will now switch to talking about the model that we use to describe this, and I will come back at various points in this to relate this model to what is seen in experiment. But let me just check before I move on to that if there are any questions about the physical setup or the experiment that anyone has before I move on to the question of modeling this.
How big is the cavity?
So it's a micro cavity. It's I think in most of the experiments it's 7 lambda. But it's somewhere between 6 and 8 lambda. So it's, you know, just a few wavelengths across. In the transverse direction, I think the active region is several millimeters up to centimeters.
This is optical.
So this is rhodamine 6G dye, which is the standard, well, one of the standard materials for dye lasers. So one of the very neat features of this is that this is an example where, in principle, you can not just look at real space images, but real color images. But when it condenses, you go from seeing light at this set of wavelengths to seeing light at this wavelength, and so the color of the light coming out changes, and you could, in principle, see that by eye.
How do you change that by just changing that?
Well, when you pump this hard enough, you see accumulation at low frequencies. The lowest frequencies, what I should point out, this is not zero. This is the, what I will call omega C, the cutoff. This is the lowest frequency for this particular longitudinal mode in the cavity. So when I say that this is a 7 lambda cavity, what I mean is that the let me draw another picture to explain that. The cavity supports a set of different longitudinal modes, and each of these longitudinal modes have various transverse sidebands for the different transverse patterns. And the experiment is using a dye molecule which has an emission and absorption spectrum something like this, and I'll get back to exactly what this looks like in a moment. It's a dye molecule, so the absorption spectrum is at higher frequencies than the emission spectrum because there are low vibrational modes of the molecule that can be excited. This omega C here is the lowest transverse mode for the particular family of modes that the dye molecules are resonant with. And so what I was saying about it changing color is you can see this accumulation at lower frequencies and so see a change to the spectrum of the system, and this is in the optical frequency regime.
Is there a way to measure the condensate fraction experimentally? I mean, do they extract some number?
In principle, yes. I'm not sure I don't recall if they try to directly extract a number.
You mentioned in passing that they change the intensity of light to condense or uncondense, and that's because they're solvent. In other words, they cannot change the physical temperature by much, right?
There are not, as far as I'm aware, any experiments that have systematically explored changing the physical temperature. You can't reduce the physical temperature a huge amount, because at some point the solvent will freeze. But there is probably a range of, it's at 300 Kelvin, you could probably go up or down 50 Kelvin without having a particular problem, but I'm not aware of any experiments that have tested that. Okay. So I've sort of started to get at the point here of what is important in modeling the system physically, which is that the reason this thermal distribution of light appears is that there is a difference between how the dye molecules absorb and re-emit light. And that's because the dye molecules have vibrational and rotational modes, so that when they absorb light, you create excitations in these vibrational modes, and therefore you absorb light at a higher frequency than the bare zero phonon line emissions or a zero phonon line spectrum of a molecule. When you emit light at a lower frequency because you can again excite vibrational modes in the process of emission. And so the cartoon of this that's normally drawn is to say, here is the energy landscape versus some nuclear coordinate of the system. Here is the ground state, electronic state of a molecule, and here is the excited electronic state, and there are these vibrational sidebands. And when you absorb light, what happens is you go from this state to one of these sidebands. It then relaxes because of collisions between the dye molecule and the solvent. And then when it emits light, it has a lower frequency transition because, again, it goes to an excited sideband and then relaxes due to collisions between the dye and the solvent. And so in order to model that kind of process, the minimum kind of model I can write down is one which includes the electronic state of a dye molecule, the photons in the cavity, and also some degree of freedom modeling the vibrational modes of the molecule. And the simplest model to write down is one where I take only a single vibrational mode for each molecule. And so the overall model I'm going to consider is something where I think about different cavity modes. So A is annihilation operator for a cavity photon, and this omega M will be omega cutoff plus some harmonic oscillator mode spacing between the different transverse modes of the cavity. So this epsilon is this splitting on this picture. So that's for photon modes, and then I will couple this to the dye molecules, and for the dye molecules I will label these by label I, and say here there is a bare transition frequency, actually I'll call this ZPL for zero phonon line of the molecule. And then that couples to light. And so far what I've written is a sort of extended Dickey model where I have got multiple photon modes coupling to multiple two-level systems. But the extra feature which is crucial to model this kind of physics and thermalization is to couple the electronic states of the molecules to the vibrational states of the molecules. And so to write that, I will consider the simplest case of just a single vibrational mode of each molecule, and write that as capital omega, b dagger i, bi, plus square root s, b dagger i, plus bi, sigma z i. So this is describing the vibrational mode as a harmonic oscillator with frequency omega. And this term here is representing the fact that what I've drawn here is that these harmonic oscillator potentials for the ground state of the molecule and the electronic excited state are not exactly overlapping. This offset here between these two points is proportional to square root s. S is the Hwang-Weiss parameter that describes this coupling between the vibrational mode and the electronic state of the molecule. And what we then want to do with that Hamiltonian is to write down a master equation which will have that Hamiltonian plus a whole set of other processes. So cavity loss and pumping of the molecules by the external laser beam, and also non-cavity emission. So that this means the fact that a molecule could in principle emit not into the cavity mode, but emit photons which escape out sideways. And then crucially, I need to also include thermalization of the vibrational modes. And so these three things here are relatively simple to write down. I can write down Lindblad terms which describe these processes. This last one, though, is a little more tricky because it's important in the physics of this system that you get a thermal distribution of these vibrational modes because the dye molecules coupled to the motion of the solvent. And that's crucial in seeing the thermal distribution of light that comes out, because what it physically says is that the relative occupation of these different sidebands is distributed according to a Boltzmann distribution. And it's that which then leads to the Boltzmann distribution in the relative energies of the photon modes which come out of the cavity. So in order to model that, what one can't just write down a simple Lindblad equation, because that would effectively correspond to an infinite temperature bath. One really needs to write down something which has a thermal noise spectrum, not just a white noise spectrum. But there is a way out in this particular problem that makes this something that's tractable to solve, which is that this whole system is in the weak coupling limit. This light-matter coupling strength G appearing here is not strong. I don't need to worry about strong coupling leading to the formation of polaritons. I can, in fact, treat this term perturbatively. And if I do that, then it's feasible to deal with the exact spectrum of the bath which couples to the modes B by making use of a transformation, a unitary transformation of the form exponential square root S sigma z b minus b dagger, and this should be product over all molecules. What that will effectively do is, on the one hand, cross out this term that couples the electronic state to the displacement of the vibrational modes, and at the same time modify this term here so that when you change electronic state, you should at the same time displace the vibrational mode. And the great advantage of doing that is that now, if what I'm going to do is make use of the fact that G is small and perturbatively, and something I can treat perturbatively, then all of this coupling to the vibrational modes is in that term which I'm going to treat perturbatively. So, and it's worth noting that what I'm going to do here is treat G as being small, but make no assumptions about how large S is. So I can treat the effect of the vibrational mode addressing the electronic transition exactly in the limit of weak coupling, where I'm talking about incoherent emission and absorption of light. And so what that really means to do is to take this term in the Hamiltonian and call this term H1, and then say that what I will do is to write down an equation dt rho is minus I H0 rho, where H0 is everything else, and then I will treat this other term perturbatively in the standard way of producing an effective dissipative term. So I will get H of t, H1 of t, H1 of t primed rho, and then I should trace over the degrees of freedom, which in this case are the vibrational modes, but I don't want to include explicitly in this Hamiltonian, and this will end up giving me a an equation of motion for the photons and for the electronic state of the molecules, and no longer require an explicit treatment of the vibrational state. So the net result of that is you get an equation of motion dt rho, where I will just write down the most important terms, the bits which come from this. What you will end up with is something that can be written as a sum over molecules and photon modes, so photon modes M, molecules labeled I, of a rate gamma minus delta M times a Lindblad term which creates a photon in mode M and removes an excitation from molecule I. And this delta M, this is equal to the frequency of mode M minus the zero phonon line of the molecule. And I'll come back to what this function gamma of delta is in just a second. And then there is another part which balances this. So this is describing emission of photons. There is a part gamma of delta M which describes the absorption of photons, AM sigma I plus. And this function gamma of delta, this comes from evaluating this trace over vibrational modes, and has the form that gamma of delta is the Fourier transform of the correlation function dTd0, where d is the operator e to the square root s b minus b dagger, this thing which is dressing this transition over here.
Sorry, is it a sort of Debye-Waller effect?
Yes, exactly that, yes. It's a Debye-Waller effect, because what this is saying is, when you cause this transition, what kind of spectrum of absorption or emission of vibrational modes occurs because of that coupling. So there's then one crucial point to note about this, which is that this form gamma of delta is guaranteed to obey the following identity, that gamma of delta is equal to gamma of minus delta times e to the minus beta delta, or at least it's guaranteed to obey that as long as this quantity appearing here, which is effectively a Green's function, so if I label this as d of t, if d of t is a Green's function of a system in thermal equilibrium, then d of t is equal to d of minus t minus I beta. So equivalently, as long as the vibrational modes are described as being in thermal equilibrium, it doesn't really matter what arbitrary non-linear function of the vibrational operators B shows up here. Any functional form of operators which are in thermal equilibrium must have this periodicity in imaginary time. And if you look at the effect of that on this Fourier transform, that gives you this relation between the absorption and emission spectra, gamma of delta and gamma of minus delta, which gives this Boltzmann factor.
So are you going to assume they are physically in thermal equilibrium?
Well, so what I'm saying here is that the assumption is that the collisions between the dye molecules and the vibrational modes mean that the vibrational modes come to thermal equilibrium. So I am going to assume that this quantity is true. If the solvent was not in thermal equilibrium, then this would break down. But that's the thing which I'm assuming to be true. I'm not assuming that the photons are in thermal equilibrium. I'm assuming that the vibrational modes come to thermal equilibrium because of the coupling to the solvent. Yes?
Tells you this is already complicated for me, but the epsilon and omega, what is their relationship? Is one much larger than the other, or does it matter?
This omega.
Capital omega, so
physically there are a range of different kinds of excitations of the molecules, and these span a range of different energy scales. In this model, we have just put in one mode, and In what we assume, we have considered a case where it's somewhat bigger than epsilon, but not orders of magnitude bigger. It turns out that none of that really strongly matters. And that's because the collisions between the dye molecules and the solvent mean that this spectrum gamma of delta has some width to all of these peaks. So the actual form of gamma of delta does look like this line plotted here. On this scale, here is omega ZPL, and red is gamma of delta, red is gamma of minus delta, and green is gamma of plus delta.
Because I thought omega ZPL is sort of like V equals zero to V equals zero.
Yes, it's the transition between the lowest states of the two effective potentials.
So epsilon, I can think of, if I want to put a number in, about 10 Kelvin?
Epsilon, the mode spacing, is...
So
in experiments, it's quite low. It's about 3 gigahertz.
but the vibrational spacing is also a few gigahertz.
Well, as I said, there's a range of different modes involved. It turns out not to matter strongly because of the collisions with the solvent causing a broadening of all of these lines. So if you didn't have the collisions with the solvent, then of course the whole story changes. But in the case where there's no collisions with the solvent, then you can get molecules where the absorption spectrum looks like this and you see clear vibrational sidebands in the spectrum. And in that case, it really matters what this width is. But if there is enough broadening that you just see this broad feature, it turns out this energy scale doesn't really matter much, because then you just have a smooth form of gamma of delta, and as long as this relation holds, then this will drive the system to equilibrium, and it won't really matter what the actual vibrational mode frequencies are.
The alphas are... the alphas in there? Alphas are...
I don't...
The last alpha. Equation in the Lindblad.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's L. L.
L. That's
L.
Lindblad.
L. Okay. So these are Lindblad operators.
Yes. So, and these operators are... Wasn't one of the things about Weitz's sort of setup was that somehow the photon number was conserved? Because every, for the process, basically kind of like what is called Compton type process where the, you absorb and emit a quantum of light.
So within this model, there is a conserved, so within what I've written so far, there is a conserved excitation number, which is number of photons plus number of excited molecules.
Got it.
Okay. And therefore, that's the sort of conserved quantity. There is, in addition to this, I should also put a loss of photons because the mirrors are not perfect.
Right.
And I should also put a external pumping which re-excites molecules. And I should put non-cavity loss of molecules. So this is the fact that molecules could, in principle, emit perpendicular to the cavity and then lose excitations. So all of these three terms at the end do change the number of excitations, but this is incoherent emission and incoherent absorption and doesn't change it.
Okay. So this gamma is a function of delta R, and here you are trying to explain that it's peaked?
It looks like this green curve. The green curve was gamma of delta, the red curve was gamma of minus delta, because delta is the distance between omega, the photon frequency, and this omega ZPL.
And that is, like, since you said the spacing was like a few gigahertz, well, think about 100 gigahertz wide?
So this thing covers hundreds of modes, of the order of 100 modes. Okay? Is there another question?
Okay.
So this formula here, in principle, now gives us most of what we need in order to understand most of the early experiments on photon condensates. Certainly to explain all of the stuff I've said here, and just to explain how that comes out of that equation, I want to talk about taking that equation and turning it into a rate equation for what is the occupation of each mode of light in the cavity, and comment on what that says in terms of the behavior in steady state. So what that really means is to say I want to write equations for Nm, which is the expectation of A dagger M Am, and I will also write something that I call N up, which is the sum over all molecules of the expectation of sigma z I plus 1 over 2. So this is for counting the number of molecules which are in an excited electronic state. And if I write semi-classical equations of motion, i.e. I assume that I can take things like A dagger, A, sigma, whatever, sigma Z, and say that factorizes, then I can go from that master equation written on the right-hand side of the board to a set of equations, closed set of equations for this number of photons in a mode M and the number of excited molecules. And it, those equations will then give a straightforward form for what happens as you pump the system harder. So what you get is that the time evolution of the number of photons in mode M has a part from the fact that photons leak out of a cavity, so a decay at rate kappa. It has emission from the excited molecules, so this is N up, into the cavity modes, and because there might be photons there already, then you get stimulated emission, and then you have absorption of photons by the unexcited molecules, so I should write N minus N up, where N is the total number of molecules, and this absorption will depend on the number of photons already there, and just for completeness, the corresponding equation for N up is equal to the rate of exciting molecules, so the molecules can be excited by absorbing photons, or they could be excited by the external pump laser exciting molecules, but only unexcited molecules can be excited. And then there is a corresponding term where molecules that are de-excited, either due to emitting into the cavity modes, or because of emitting into non-cavity modes. And so one can then solve these equations to look at all the time dynamics and to look at what steady state you get. But there's a very straightforward point you can understand about why you get an equilibrium Bose-Einstein distribution in this equation, which is to say, in the limit that the cavity is good, and so you ignore this cavity loss, then what I have to do is to balance these two terms in the equation of motion for the number of photons in the cavity, and that means that the steady state can be written as obeying nm over nm plus 1 is going to be equal to gamma of minus delta m over gamma of delta m times this property of how many molecules are excited, and that will look like n up over n minus n up. And this gamma of minus delta m over gamma of delta m, we have this relation here that says there is this Boltzmann factor, and so this whole thing will end up looking like e to the minus beta delta m, and this thing here you can map as being effectively a chemical potential of this system, because it plays, I mean, this will play the role of setting a chemical potential for this as a Bose-Einstein distribution, because if you just invert that equation, you get that nm is equal to 1 over e to the beta delta m minus mu minus 1. So what this is physically saying is the reason that you get a thermal distribution here is because of this ratio of gamma of minus delta over gamma of delta, and the reason that that is thermal is because of this periodicity in imaginary time, this Kuber-Martin-Schwinger relation, which comes physically from the fact that the vibrational states of the molecules are in thermal equilibrium.
Can I just ask, so ordinarily a density matrix, that density matrix involves A's and sigmas and could in principle be very complicated. The fact that you reduce this to the dynamical evolution of effectively classical variables,
yeah,
that somehow...
That's an approximation which holds well in the limit that the occupations of modes are particularly large.
And the classical, yeah. So all kinds of off-diagonal coherences are, or sigma x's, or it's just truncated, is that right?
Yes, there's an implicit assumption that I make but don't actually write down in the equations, because it's not that useful to write it and deal with step by step. And that is that there's another effect of the collisions between the molecules and the solvent, which is that it's hard to maintain any coherent superposition of molecular states, you can maintain some population, some excited population, but there is a very strong dephasing term on the molecules. Now, the reason I don't write that explicitly here is because there's nothing which creates any coherence in the first place in all of these equations. And so if I just say, well, the coherence is zero and it stays zero at all times, that's a valid description of the system.
So you don't have any collisional processes that, like, doesn't electronic de-excitation of the molecule?
Well, if they existed, they could be included in this. So I've described this as mostly being due to the photons that are emitted not into the cavity mode, but which leak out transverse to the cavity. But this could describe any process which de-excites a molecule without putting a photon into the cavity.
Would you say that the vibrational temperature in both electronic states is the same? Or am I missing that?
The vibrational temperature is the same, yes.
That says that the process very slow, the process of a collisional de-excitation.
Slow compared to the thermalization, yes. So in all of this, I effectively by writing this, I am assuming that the thermalization of a vibrational degree of freedom is the fastest process in the system. And that is physically correct. That the dye molecule undergoes many collisions with the solvent molecule before it emits a photon.
So you don't treat this thermalization dynamic, you just assume that the correlation of thermal.
I assume that the solvent is thermal. This gives this function, this form of gamma of delta. What I've said here is that if I ignore the cavity losses, that immediately leads to a thermal distribution of photons. What you can then do numerically is also put back in the cavity losses and see what level of cavity loss can be tolerated. And it's perhaps worth mentioning that what you see is, when the cavity loss is small, you indeed see a Bose-Einstein distribution, if I plot nm versus omega m. When the cavity loss is high, what you see is something like this, and actually when you pump it very hard, you get a mode which is not the lowest frequency in the cavity, lowest frequency mode, becoming macroscopically occupied. And so what this is telling you is that the reason that in the limit of a good cavity you get a Bose-Einstein distribution is because, it's not because of what the emission spectrum of the molecules looks like. It's because of the ratio of emission and absorption spectra. Whereas when the cavity loss is very large, I can actually still write an equation like this, but what I should do is say I have plus kappa here in the denominator. And so when the cavity loss is very large, then actually this term, this reabsorption of light, becomes irrelevant. And if the cavity loss is large, then what matters is the spectrum of emission of the molecules. And the picture which I've now erased, what I had sort of shown on there was, here is the lowest mode in the cavity. And I forgot which way around was red and green. I think I used green for the emission spectrum. But it is something like that. The peak emission is nowhere near the lowest mode in the cavity. The modes that get macroscopically occupied are well into the tail of this emission spectrum, and they get macroscopically occupied not because the emission is strong, but because the ratio of emission over absorption is strongest there, because absorption looks like that. So I don't assume that the steady state is thermal. I do assume that this function from the solvent is thermal.
What's the role of G here? This is in the weak.
This is all in the weak coupling limit. So G shows up as a prefactor in this gamma. So really I've missed G squared.
So that's why you can also ignore all this off-diagonal stuff, I guess. It must relate to
this. Yes. So this is all in weak coupling, and it is indeed a very interesting question how to explore the crossover between weak and strong coupling in this kind of model. Okay. So I'm looking at my watch and realize that it's already 70 minutes, and I'm halfway through. Are people interested for me to carry on talking about spatial pattern formation?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, whilst you're erasing, can I... So in the experiment, it's not really done with a continuous wave light replenishment, but rather sort of a squirt, measure, is that right?
So I think no experiment is truly continuous wave, because the problem then is you start to heat the whole sample too much.
Right.
There are experiments where the duration of the pulse is long compared to all time scales of the system, and so it may as well be continuous wave. There are also experiments, which I'm just going to mention in a second, where there is a short pulse excitation, and then you look at the subsequent dynamics.
So, but in principle, this formalism allows you to compute transients and...
Yes.
Question is whether that's something that the experiment would be interested to.
Well, they did look at the transient behavior, and we have calculated the transient behavior from this, and what you see is at early times, the spectrum of photons follows the emission spectrum of the molecules, and as the absorption occurs, then you start to get that it follows this balance and this Boltzmann distribution.
So, and for the solvent, you assume that it obeys equilibrium conditions, but the precise functional form doesn't matter because why?
So the precise functional form of what?
Of D.
So in effect, the functional form of gamma. So the functional form of gamma does matter for what the transient behavior is, and it does matter if the cavity loss is large and it doesn't reach equilibrium. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter for the steady state when it equilibrates, because all that shows up is the ratio of gamma of delta over gamma of minus delta.
Yeah, I guess what I'm thinking is that physically liquids, I don't know about the solvent, but physically liquids have a lot of fast motion, which presumably makes everything safe, but there's also, on some scales, it sort of looks like a solid also. Basically, there are some random fluctuations in the density. I don't know what's spatial.
So I think none of that would really affect what form this D would really take, because D is a Green's function of the vibrational mode calculated due to the effect of the solvent colliding with it. So as long as there are some fast modes, right, it doesn't matter what the other slow modes do.
Okay.
So the other thing which I want to talk about, and I will try and cut down what I'm going to say, is that what I've described so far is adequate to explain the early experiments, but there are already things in the early experiments which you can't properly explain with this. And that's much more clearly so with more recent experiments, where people have looked at two kinds of things. One is to say, this whole problem is effectively in a harmonic trap. That's because of the curvature of the mirrors. And in a harmonic trap, there will be some equilibrium size of the cloud, and when it condenses, you get a sharp peak because of the ground mode of the cloud. And you can explore what happens when you change the shape of the pump. So you can ask what happens if the pump is this shape versus what happens if the pump is this shape. And the answer that you see experimentally is that as you change the width of the pump, the width of the cloud, this is plotted well below threshold, so when it's not in a condensed state, you see that this goes up and then saturates, and the value that it saturates is almost the thermal value. So it does look like a thermal system when the pump width is large, but when you have a narrow pump, you don't see full equilibration. And the other kind of experiment which I want to say something more about is experiments where you pump off to one side. And these are experiments which use the pulse pump. So they dump a lot of energy into the molecules sitting at one side of the cavity, and then look at the subsequent time evolution. And what you see there is that you excited molecules off to one side to begin with, and then because it's a harmonic oscillator potential, the photon condensate oscillates from side to side. But what you also see is that at late times, for some conditions, you see a cloud appearing in the middle, a condensate in the equilibrium position of the trap. And what I've described so far can't describe that, because in all that I've written so far, I've assumed it doesn't matter where an excited molecule sits in terms of describing how it couples to photons. And you can rectify that fairly easily, at least for the first of these problems, but for the second of these problems, it introduces something which is a sort of more fundamental issue. So for the first of these problems, for just pumping with different widths, all you really need to do is to rewrite the density matrix equation so that it has the same terms as before, but whenever I talk about emitting into photon mode M from molecule I, as well as caring about what the emission spectrum is as a function of energy, I should also care about what the overlap between mode M and the position of molecule I is. So I get this A dagger M sigma I minus. And from that, I can then say, well, what this will effectively do is say that I can no longer write down a simple equation of motion for the total number of excited molecules. I have to write down equations of motion, say the number of photons in mode M, it has the photon loss, and this emission term here will now give me something that looks like gamma minus delta M times nm plus 1, and rather than having just the total number of excited molecules, I will write something here which is the density of molecules times an overlap om, where om is the overlap between where the excited molecules are sitting. So I'll write f of r, which is the fraction of excited molecules. An overlap between that and the profile of this mode M. So what this is saying is it now matters where a molecule sits, because if it is not overlapping with the mode it's supposed to emit into, it won't emit. And similarly, the absorption term will look like minus gamma of delta M times NM, and I will have here rho 0, 1 minus OM. The 1 is coming because of the integral of a uniform profile of molecules with mod psi m squared, and if psi m is normalized, it does turns into this one. So that means that now what you will get in steady state of this is nm over nm plus 1 having this Boltzmann factor, but now we will also get a factor om over 1 minus om. And the crucial difference in this formula to what I had before is that this depends on which mode I'm talking about. And so what this tells you physically is that when the pump spot is very small, you can only overlap with modes which are concentrated at the center of the cavity. This OM will vanish for higher order modes. And so what that effectively means is even if it's for, even if the energy would favor populating higher order modes, this small overlap will suppress those modes. And so what you will see is that when the pump spot is small, you can only populate low-order modes, and the low-order modes are concentrated at the middle of the cavity, so the cloud that you get looks unnaturally cold, unnaturally small, because it's concentrated on low-energy modes just because of spatial overlap.
Would it be possible to condense on different modes rather than in the lowest mode? Say the effective chemical potential will depend on the mode. Right,
so if I just put in Gaussian spots, then I think all I can do is favor the lowest mode even more. If I put in a ring pump, then in principle, yes. So then you could make this OM depend on... I should say two things. In principle, yes. The other thing I should say, though, is that this formula that I've written here is specific to the case... this formula is fine, The assumption that I'm implicitly making in what I said is that I'm thinking that this F of R, where the excited molecules sit, depends on the shape of the pump. That statement is true far below threshold, but as you approach threshold, you start to get significant re-emission, and so F of R no longer follows the pump. You can affect the threshold properties by the shape of the cloud, so it probably is in principle possible to find conditions where that occurs, but probably that has to be in a fairly bad cavity, because if it's a good cavity, there will be sufficient reabsorption and emission, but it ceases to matter where the pump is. Okay. So I will just go on for 5 minutes more, if that's okay, because I wanted to get as far as making the statement which I was hoping someone will argue with. And I won't have time to talk about the toy model, which is why I believe the answer I'm going to give. But the problem is that this theory is also not adequate. It's fine for explaining the effect of pump spot size on the properties of the condensate, but it's not fine for describing any kind of dynamical oscillations. And it's sort of obvious why it's not fine, because what happens in this equation is that I emit into photon modes. I create populations of modes. And the photon modes are Gauss-Hermite polynomials in a harmonic oscillator trap. And the modulus squared of a Gauss-Hermite is symmetric. So firstly, I couldn't even describe the initial state here, which is off-centered. But much more importantly, I can't describe the oscillations by just having populations of modes. If I want to have oscillations, there has to be beating, there has to be superpositions of different photon modes, and that phase in the superposition will evolve in time, and that will lead to the oscillation of this wave packet. And that means I can't write this equation. So there are two things I could imagine trying to write. The first thing I could imagine trying to write is to say, well, what's wrong here is that because I'm just emitting into a photon mode, let me write something where I put the sum over modes inside this operator and say I have something like psi m of ri times a dagger m sigma I minus. That would sort of do that physics correctly. It would emit into superpositions of modes because it would say a molecule at position I emits into this particular superposition of photon modes, and this superposition will then evolve due to the Hamiltonian and it will oscillate. But what that misses is that this will never thermalize. This will never reach thermal equilibrium because the thermal equilibrium came from the fact that the emission rate into mode M depended on the frequency delta M, the detuning, and so you need a different frequency, a different emission rate for each mode, and this is now a superposition of many modes, so it's not at all obvious what form of gamma I should put here, and regardless of which one I choose, I won't have an M-dependent answer, so I won't have this thermalization. So this is something I could imagine writing, but this is also fairly ad hoc. It's not derived from any microscopic theory. The other thing I can do is to go back and read the papers of Redfield from the 1970s about why one should not necessarily expect all equations to be in Lindblad form. And what that suggests I should instead write is an equation dt rho, which has a slightly more complicated form. So I have a sum over modes m and modes m primed and molecules. And I will write here a quantity which I will call L emission for mode M, M primed I. And then I will write something which is a bit like a Lindblad operator, but is not diagonal. So this is the process, so that should be dagger and minus. This is the emission process, so it creates a photon in mode M or in mode M primed. And then I have the standard other term, A M primed, A dagger M, sigma I plus, sigma I minus, anticommutator. And this matrix L E M M primed I should take a form which is rather messy, but has in it the overlap between the molecule at position Ri and these modes, and also has in it a function which I will call k of minus delta m plus k star of minus delta m primed over 2. And the real part of k of delta is gamma of delta, and k of delta is analytic in the lower half plane. So k of delta is the analytic continuation of this emission rate gamma.
Which are the hypotheses of this Radcliffe field with respect to the Lindahl? Which is the hypothesis missing?
So what I could do from here is I could get to this equation. If I make the standard thing written in most textbooks, that I should secularize the equation, which means that I should cross out all cross terms which are time dependent in the interaction picture, and that physically means crossing out all terms with m not equal to m primed.
Well, I guarantee that this is trace preserving.
It's trace preserving, yes. No,
exactly.
It is not positive definite, and so this is the point I want to raise as an argument. I have two statements to make, and then I'll stop. So, in the context of this model, of this physical problem, we are driven to this by the physics, and we're driven to this by the physics because we see oscillations, and we see that the oscillations thermalize at late time. And I can write down Lindblad equations which do one of those two things, but I can't write down a Lindblad form which does both. I can choose to write down this, which will cause the oscillations but won't thermalize, and this is a perfectly valid Lindblad form, or this, which will thermalize but won't oscillate. But if I want both, then what I want, microscopically, is a process of emission which allows creation of superpositions. So secularization could never work, and secularization explicitly is crossing out the process of creating superpositions of different modes. And I also want that the emission rates into those modes depend on the mode M. And I'm forced really to get this kind of form. This is also what you get microscopically deriving the Redfield equation in the standard textbook way. It is stable. It is not guaranteed to preserve positivity. If I had spent less time in the first half of this talk, what I would also have gone through is a toy model that we have looked at, which is two bosonic modes coupled to a bath. And the point about that model is that we could solve everything exactly. We can say exactly what the time evolution is, exactly what the steady state properties are. And we compared this to three theories, to the behavior of the secularized master equation. And the secularized master equation is sort of plausible in most places, but what it gets wrong is that there really is coherence between different modes, even when they're detuned off resonance. It's very small, but it's non-zero. And also, it can't describe the behavior when two modes are resonant and you will get coherences. You could also write down the analog of this. This kind of theory is very wrong for that toy problem because it predicts coherence under almost all conditions, and that's not really correct. What you can thirdly write down is the Redfield theory. And yes, it's not preserving positivity, but it does basically perfectly match the exact solution. And so really, driven by the context of this problem, we've been forced into the position of saying that this requirement to preserve positivity may be important if you have a choice, but in this case, you have a choice between describing the physically observed behavior and an equation which preserves positivity. And our view on what this is saying at the moment is that this is an approximate description, and one of the things that it gets wrong is that it doesn't keep positivity exactly, but it gets all other things right at leading order, and so it's less clear that what one should favor positivity as the primary goal.
For non-expert, positivity of what?
But positivity is the statement that the density matrix should have only positive eigenvalues, because they can be interpreted as probabilities, and what Lindblad showed was that equations of Lindblad form have the property that it is guaranteed that if the eigenvalues of a density matrix are positive to begin with, they remain positive for all times.
Okay, but then I have a related question. Sorry, follow-up question. So, isn't it true that if you truncate density matrix evolution equations in any way, that's not rigorously, you're not, for example, at some point you said that I'm going to stick to the G squared term.
That's the point about Lindblad form, is that Lindblad forms, even when approximate, guarantee positivity is preserved.
Right.
I should.
You've restored positivity, I would say, in an ad hoc way by. Because it seems to me that you've already opened yourself to the possibility, or not you, but the.
Well, I say it's like when you do, I don't know, perturbation expansion, which are conserved. I mean.
That's
kind of warm identities.
But there you sort of do it at the equation of motion level. But okay, I actually don't know the whole problem.
So there are lots of questions. So I think.
This oscillation relates to the coherences.
Yes.
Different one. What would you say sets its phase?
It's set by the fact that you pumped off center, and so you set up the initial conditions.
Some initial coherence is injected.
It's not coherence that's injected. It's that what is injected is exciting molecules away from the center of the harmonic trap. And so when they emit, they must emit it to create a wave packet at one particular position in space, and that means a particular phase between the modes.
So also not being an expert, but I had expected even in your earlier model that you would have talked about other correlation functions as opposed to these A dagger M. I could have expected A dagger M, A dagger K. So that would be coherences. Why did they not play a role?
Well, the equations don't create them unless I have this form. So until I have this form, those coherences, if they start at zero, will maintain at zero. You could explore how they decay, but the basic point is unless you have this physics here, or of these cross terms, there is nothing in the equation which creates those coherences.
Destroys them.
Well,
they were created by the pumping off center.
Yes. So there are things which destroy them, which are the photon loss, but nothing that creates them.
I have a question. So you were mentioning that Redfield treated this kind of, let's say, non-Lindblad master equation. In which context did he have to do with that?
So I think this was all originally in the context of nuclear magnetic resonance. But the statement which is in Redfield's paper, which is worth rereading, is there's a paper of Redfield which comes out after Bloch's paper where he proposed secularization. And Redfield actually gives a different reason to the one I gave for not using secularization. What Redfield points out is that in order to secularize, you must cross out all terms which are off diagonal in frequencies. And that means that you can only secularize if you can exactly solve your Hamiltonian. So although he was looking at problems where it turned out you could exactly solve this, what he observed is if you have a very large problem, some sort of lattice problem, if you think about the kinds of problems we're looking at now, secularization of the many-body problem in the eigenbasis requires knowing the full spectrum of that problem before you even write down the equation of motion. And so Redfield's point was, if you want to be able to write down equations of motion for problems you can't exactly solve, you can't secularize.
I'm not sure I completely follow this, because I guess it's a multi-mode picture, but could you stick to the previous one and assume that there is some normal covariant things going on here, some memory effects, and they produce oscillations?
This one produces oscillations.
No, but both.
It causes damping. I think there's nothing you can do with this diagonal form to produce oscillations. Well, there might be ways of having non-Markovian forms.
No, but also, I have the same question. Did you check this criteria, like this distance, to see if this is affecting non-Markovian dynamics?
So, We don't have an exact solution of this problem. So I don't have... I mean, trace distance for checking non-Markoviianity is useful if you have an exact solution and you want to then look at the subsequent dynamics. So in that case, I can't answer it. In the case of two coupled bosonic modes, we have the exact solution. We didn't check trace distance. There is a statement that we can make there, which is that there is another consequence of using non-Lindblad forms, which is, as well as not ensuring positivity, there are cases where that can cause real drastic problems, but the equations are unstable and modes grow without limits. In that case, we can also check exactly what the eigenvalues of the Heisenberg equations are, and we can prove that they are stable as long as the system is reasonably Markovian. And so in that context, what we can say is, when the system is fairly Markovian, it doesn't cause a drastic problem to use this non-Lindblad form, in that all the eigenvalues stay positive and there's no instabilities. And but when it does go wrong, actually the whole process has gone, but the whole equation is wrong already because it was a very non-Markovian situation.
Somehow, this kind of your assurance that you cannot have these cross couplings while you keep the Lindblad form, somehow. Can I finish my question? So I would try two things, which you probably have tried, but I wonder how that came up. The one would be that the first thing that you probably would write down in your Hamiltonian, if you kind of approach this really naively, would be to write it as a Hamiltonian, then do a Wigner-Weisskopf like kind of tracing over, in which case that, for example, becomes a Lindblad form. Or you already a priori define your Lindblad operators such that they have this, that your Lindblad operators are already kind of combined operators that have this cross-coupling basically explicitly in already, but still have the Lindblad form. I mean, they look a little bit more complicated than usual. Is that both not possible in this case?
So I'm not really sure about Wigner-Weisskopf, because I don't think I can do Wigner-Weisskopf in this case of the photon condensate model, where what I'm describing is this incoherent emission involving two operators, or at least I don't know how to do this. The second point, this is a form of Lindblad form which does have cross couplings in, but what it doesn't have in is thermalization, and that's because this form puts the sum over modes inside the operator, and so it creates this whole superposition. And this is completely ad hoc, and I have no way of justifying it, but would give a Lindblad form which seems to have the desired properties, which would be to put minus gamma of delta m here under the square root. And then the diagonal bits would be right. So, and actually, it's not that far off this thing. If I say that what I should have here is not this, but is square root of k of minus delta m, k star of minus delta m, I should replace the arithmetic means which come out of Redfield theory by geometric means, then I would get that form. So my problem with that is I know a microscopic way to go step by step and produce the Redfield equation. I construct this double commutator, I trace out the bar, I get the Redfield equation, and then the normal thing that textbooks say is then you should make the then you should perform secularization by crossing out cross terms. I know that can't be right. I don't know any microscopic way to justify this square root.
There is no perturbation.
Yes.
Yes. From any perturbation.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is I can imagine a form which is a Lindblad form which has the right required physics in it, but I can't derive it. And I can say it's not that far off this, because if I don't worry about modes that are very far apart, which probably don't really matter, it's probably only coherences between nearby modes which matter for producing wave packets, then for those nearby modes, if these rates are fairly similar, geometric and arithmetic means are not that different. So this will sort of, this sort of explains also why using this rather than this, that this one does give Lindblad form, this doesn't. So it's not that far off an equation which would conserve positivity. But this is what comes out of a microscopic calculation. And if there is a way of doing a microscopic calculation that produced that, I'd love to see it. But as Sarah said, you can't expect a square root to come out of a perturbative treatment.
Just a very crazy thought, but since this gamma is essentially this spin function of the boson, right?
Yeah.
You get this fancy power loss when you have some sort of Lattinger liquid kind of stuff, because you see this is like a vertex of Hedberg, and this you get a power law in front of it, which is 1 over k, where k is the Lattinger. So here you have just harmonic bosons.
Yeah.
But if you have bosons with this funny spectrum, I think you might get the. You see what I mean?
Linear. Well, I do, but the point is, I have this physical system.
I understand.
Yeah. I think I've exhausted the questions.
Okay, yes. Thank you very much. Okay.